Welcome to Taught Not Told, the podcast that brings together diverse perspectives, life lessons, and stories to challenge how we think, grow, and see the world. Today's guest is someone who has spent his life standing up for those who are too often ignored. Mr. Tim Costello AO is one of Australia's most recognised voices in social justice, fighting for gambling reform, poverty alleviation, refugee rights, and humanitarian aid. He's been a lawyer, a pastor, a mayor, and the CEO of World Vision Australia, leading global relief efforts in disaster-stricken areas. But beyond all of the work he's done, what stands out the most about Mr. Costello is the way that he chooses to show up. In the places where change is hardest, where power is deeply entrenched, and where speaking out often comes with consequences. I wanted to speak with Mr. Costello because his career challenges the idea that fighting for justice is something abstract or reserved for politicians and policymakers. His work proves that change happens when people decide to stand up, even when the odds aren't in their favour. In this conversation, we talk about what shaped his journey, the resistance that he's faced, and the decisions that have defined his life's work. Mr. Costello's perspective made me rethink a lot about what it means to take action, and I think that you'll gain a lot from this conversation too. So that being said, let's get into it. Mr. Costello, welcome to Taught Not Told. I've really been looking forward to this conversation, and I'm so grateful that you could join us, and there's so much that I'm excited to explore with you today. Before we kick off, if you don't mind, could you give a brief introduction of who you are to my audience?
Sure. So I'm now so old I didn't study ancient history. I lived through it. So I did what we then used to call HSC, your last year of school, back in 1972. And I went from my school down the road from yours. I was a Carey Grammar to study law at Monash. And I worked as a lawyer. I went overseas to study theology. I came back and did a range of things. So through my life, I've been very blessed to largely be that generation that had university education for free, no hex fees, that missed the Vietnam War. I was too young, so wasn't going to be conscripted. And largely for my generation, it's been a time of peace, of affluence, of really us baby boomers having the best of all that Australia could give. So I look back and think I have been lucky, blessed, and certainly, as we'll talk in this interview, I need to give back.
Thank you so much. Very interesting. So I'd love to start now with your upbringing. From what I've read about you, you grew up as the eldest son of two teachers. Is that right?
Yes.
I was curious as to how that would have shaped your view of the world. I mean, I assume that environment would have been quite formative to you growing up. So how would you say that it influenced you, how you approach leadership and responsibility, and also your sense of duty to others?
Yes, so both their teaching vocation and their character were the extraordinary things about my parents. Dad was in the private system. He taught at Carey Baptist Grammar School. Mum in the state system, taught at Blackburn South High. Both had this innate curiosity. So our dinner table was like a classroom. Our trips on holidays to Sydney or to Adelaide was like a mobile classroom. We would be taught from an early age the capitals of different European countries. So we'd be stopping in country towns on the way to our holiday destination and looking at the Anzac First World War Memorial and talking about the causes of the First World War. So it was probably different to other people in that my parents never missed an opportunity to go on teaching, to go on arousing curiosity, to prodding us to ask the question, why are things the way they are? And is it possible for things to be different? So their shaping was profoundly important.
Thank you for that. That's very interesting what you say about teaching you not only what's going on in the world, but also, you know, what are the problems and what can be fixed. So kind of building on from that, I mean, your career has been defined by a lot of giving back and service and also advocacy for many social issues. But I was wondering, before that calling became clear to you, was this always something that you wanted to do in the future? I mean, did you ever feel uncertain about the path that you were embarking on?
Well, as a teenage boy, I just wanted to play AFL football for Essendon and cricket for Australia. I was very sporting obsessed, and I must admit, secondary school I loved, sailed through, but didn't really think about my future. And looking back, I think the times were different. They were the late 1960s, early 1970s. There was this sense that Australia was safe, that we were blessed, that unemployment was low, that I didn't have to worry. I certainly went into law, not particularly because I was passionate about advocacy, which I have done later in life, but I was passionate about not having to work, and law was the longest degree, 5 years. So I did it for all the wrong reasons. And even after doing a law degree, I didn't want to really go to work, so I did a diploma of education. So I stayed at university 6 years, and it was a time of sport, friendship, starting to think, slowly about the future. And 6 weeks of teacher training in the classroom convinced me law was a very good idea. I take my hat off to teachers having to maintain discipline and be so responsible for learning. So I did go and do law after a diploma of education. And what really happened for me was representing criminal clients at court. I was doing a lot of criminal law and family law. I got a little bit jaded and depressed. People who once loved each other in family law, fighting over custody and over the house, scratching each other's eyes out. Criminals I represented were always repentant on the court steps, but you kept them out of trouble, out of prison, really, not out of trouble. Kept them out of prison and they go back to their old ways. And I thought, what am I doing? So that's really why I went off with my wife. We married young at 24 to study theology in Zurich in Switzerland, thinking, I just want to think about the bigger questions of life. That's really where the questions of advocacy and what, how can I make a difference kicked in. Up to then, it was a pretty layback dream run for me.
What you say about, your time in college, kind of enjoying that time and doing lots of sport, living your life. You mentioned starting to think really more about your future during that time. I mean, as a teenager, a lot of the other people who are my age, they're all thinking about what they want to do pretty much now. And I think, especially in my generation and in the younger generations, it's quite common for young people to start thinking about what they want to do and thinking about how they're going to make a difference in this world that we live in. So, I mean, would you say that was always the case, or was that something you started to really think about maybe around college or like going into work?
Yeah, no, I think it wasn't always the case. I think the profound difference between my generation and what you're describing, Ivy, was that we had a sense that life was safe, good, that, you could get very serious early and say, I'm going to work hard, make a lot of money, or get the best university degree to do X, Y, and Z, climb the ladder of my career. But a lot of us didn't think that way. We just didn't. We actually thought, no, life's more about relationships and sport and kicking back with your friends. It was quite different, quite different. I don't think you can compare epochs and say one is better than the other, but I do think some of the pressures we put on people your age, Ivy, produces anxiety. And I must get on with it. And I must, in year 10, be dusting up my CV with volunteering work and this and that. I do think that is a lot of pressure and it makes me a bit sad. That wasn't my experience.
I mean, what you say, I think I definitely agree because I think, life isn't just about like getting on with the next thing. And with social media and everything, it feels like everything's moving so quickly and you're hearing about, world news and all of these things happening in the world. But in day-to-day life as well. It feels very fast-paced. So something I'd love really is to have kind of that focus on community and family and sport, as you say. I think that's definitely, it's not black and white really. I mean, you've kind of touched on this a little bit, but studying theology overseas and then returning to serve in Melbourne must have been a pretty transformative period in your life. I mean, not only were you deepening your understanding of faith, but you were also like preparing to apply it in real life situations and in very practical ways. So I wanted to ask, how did those experiences change the way that you saw leadership, purpose, and your role in society?
Yes, I came back and opened a law office in a little Baptist church in St Kilda. They couldn't pay me, but wanted me to preach for them. So the law office paid for me and my family, and it was a poverty law practice because there was a lot of poverty in St Kilda back in the early 1980s. A lot of drugs, a lot of prostitution, sex workers, a lot of runaway kids from the eastern suburbs ran away to St Kilda, a lot of mentally ill in big rundown boarding houses. So St Kilda was a needy area. And so I think purpose for me was saying, I've got skills, they're legal, they're pastoral. The legal skills, I was able to apply the pastoral skills. We built a church congregation that welcomed everybody, whatever their sexuality or mental health or background, that bought a house for runaway kids, Macassar House, that bought a big boarding house for people who were not being treated very well because of their mental illness, and ran a really caring, committed boarding house that started a street sort of workhouse down in the red light area, with lunchtime, breakfast and lunchtimes. So I think I found my purpose in serving and giving, curiously, is the best way to happiness. I think people who seek happiness often miss it. One of my favorite theologians, Soren Kierkegaard, said, "The door to happiness turns outwards. When you turn inwards, you're often feeling resentful and you missed out and envious of someone who's doing better. And how could I be slighted by that person? I'm anxious that I'm not performing. It's me, me, me." When you turn outwards, it's actually about us, not me. And I think I discovered purpose in a law practice in St Kilda in the church, building a congregation that was caring, inclusive, that was rich community, wonderful friendships. My best friends still today are from those days 40 years ago. So the leadership model was really sort of a bit countercultural. It said, you know what, if we spent our lives climbing the career ladder only to get to the top, a lot of money and status and therefore social honor, only to find that the ladder was leaning against the wrong wall. In other words, maybe there's another ladder, a ladder of meaning, of calling, of serving, of giving, of community and relationship. And that ladder is worth climbing. So our leadership style was really around, in a countercultural way, saying, what's it all about for you? Where does your happiness intersect with the world's need? Where does your happiness intersect with the world's need? And how can we actually give meaning and community to your life? So that was the style.
That was great. I mean, this is kind of a bit philosophical, but do you think these two ladders, the ladder of climbing in the career realm and the ladder of, finding happiness and giving back, can these two ladders be climbed at the same time? And do you think you've been able to do that?
Yeah, I think for people, my parents are a good example. The career ladder and the calling ladder were aligned in sync. They were being paid as teachers professionally for what they really felt called to do. And I think that's often the case. You know, there are some business people just born to be entrepreneurs, creating jobs, called doing what they're doing and being successful. Nurses and maybe doctors. I think A lot of times the meaning calling ladder aligns with the career ladder. I think where the catch in our society is that we've actually thought that the career ladder is, of course, the dominant one. And if you're offered a promotion with more pay and social worth, of course you would take it. Actually, that promotion may mean less time for your art, your music, your volunteering, your service. And therefore, it's better not to take the promotion on the career ladder and to make a choice. And I do think, Ivy, there are people who are in jobs which are, they pay, but they're not meaningful. But you put food on the table for your family. I think those people need to say, yes, but I still have a meaning calling ladder. And I'm still a coach of football and netball. I'm still running scouts. I'm still giving. I'm still expressing the things that are my calling, even though the job isn't, the career isn't particularly rewarding.
Thank you for that. Talking about art and that kind of area, I'm someone who really loves art and music. I think these are some of my biggest passions, something I've been doing since I was really, really young. And I definitely feel what you've been saying about, our society promoting the career ladder, and that sense of climbing forward and up is like what progress is. And it's hard sometimes because, for example, I play the cello and it's something I really enjoy, but it's hard. It's hard to live multiple lives and pursue all of the things that you really want to do because we have limited time in the end. So I was wondering, you mentioned, you can work at a certain job, but you can also be a sports coach on the side, or you can volunteer. So it's not really like a one single path that you're locked into. Do you have any advice for young people who want to balance all of these different, aspects of their life and their passions?
Yeah, I think it's important to see that there are seasons in life. I think women who've been told professionally you are as good as, if not much better than men who are in your area, so go for it, have the season when they go, I can take this career step or I can choose to have a child. Having a child will pull me aside from the career. And I think women are better at going, you know what, this season, I think this is really important. And yep, it might penalize me. Men, I think, not being the ones that bear children, don't get this often. They just keep climbing, climbing. And I think that's why for men, they are so lost at retirement. I think so many men retire, spend a year cleaning out their back shed and then have a heart attack and die because they actually haven't thought about who they are, the broader range of who they are, and the seasons of life. So I really think it's important to recognize that whatever your ATAR score, you love playing the cello, and that gift is going to be with you for all your life, and you're going to get pleasure and you're going to give others pleasure. That is part of your calling. That is part of your calling.
Thank you. That's really a nice thought to keep with me and my listeners as well, of course. Kind of turning the direction a little bit, advocacy, which you've been kind of working in quite a lot, often means stepping into conflict and standing up for what you believe in. That could mean, challenging power structures or standing up for change or facing resistance. And I feel like in today's world, a lot of people feel nervous about speaking up. There's this whole like cancel culture going on, and it's hard to say what you mean for fear of backlash or feeling like you won't be heard. So, what advice would you give about having difficult conversations and standing firm in your beliefs?
Yes, I believe you need to be strong with the wealthy and the powerful, and particularly gentle with those who are struggling and vulnerable. The wealthy and the powerful often have bent the rules to serve themselves. We know that there are fossil fuel billionaires who want more billions rather than be concerned about the future of their grandchildren, for that matter, my grandchildren. And they have bent the rules. We know that the tech moguls who just say, oh no, we've just created a platform and people can express their views on that. No, the algorithms have shaped people. Their user engagement has worked out that rage, catastrophe, misinformation gets more clicks. They're shaping character, they're forming personality. And the tech moguls know that a new information network isn't just about uncovering truth. It's about new political and economic structures that often benefit them. And that's why they say, oh, well, we'll comply with the law. They've got massive lobby groups making sure they're not properly regulated for their misinformation and catastrophizing and rage and the polarization that comes. So I say, as advocates, we have to be very strong, sometimes very hard with those who have made the rules. Politics, at the end of the day, is simply this: whose policies were the rules set by, and who are they benefiting? Who wins? Who misses out? That's what politics is essentially about. So I've been engaged in as an advocate in that, and at times I've been very hard on the gambling industry and on politicians captured by other powerful industries that I think have bent the rules to their benefit.
That really resonates with me. And what you said kind of it reminded me of something I saw, which is it's not left versus right, it's up versus down. Because I feel like there's so much polarization in the world today. We all know that the media is very biased, but I think a lot of people tend to think that that's solely like a political bias, which I don't really think it's true. A big part of it, as you said, is clicks, and that's shaping a lot of what we're exposed to as well. So that really resonated with me. But as you mentioned, you've spent decades working on issues that are incredibly complex, like poverty and gambling reform. So I wanted to ask, how do you measure progress in an area of work that isn't really complete because it's an ongoing issue?
Yes, so on poverty nationally, we have very good statistics about the number of children, for example, in Australia still living in poverty, and we can benchmark that from a year ago, from 10 years ago. We have a poverty line, and ACOS, the Australian Council of Social Services, is largely the advocate advocating those benchmarks, advocating for what was, the unemployment benefit to actually be enough for children to not be raised in poverty. Globally, we have benchmarks. They're called the Sustainable Development Goals. And we knew with their predecessor, the Millennium Development Goals, that we had seen from 2000 to 2015, we had lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And the world, when it set its mind to, showed how much progress it could make on poverty. Now, with the pandemic and with conflict, we have seen those slippage in those goals, but we can measure how we are going on poverty, how we are going on inequality. And we know that inequality is an issue we have to watch here in Australia. It's not nearly as bad as America, because we have a targeted welfare system. In America, the billionaires sitting behind Trump at the inauguration own more wealth personally than 50% of the whole of the bottom half of the American population. That's, 170 million people. That's three billionaires. They've got great inequality. Gambling, exactly the same. We have a hard data that comes out each year about the losses for Australians on gambling that continues to go up. And we have the greatest losses per capita in the world. The nation that comes second is 40% less losses than us per capita. That's how far ahead and out of control gambling losses are. But we have very good data to measure how that's going.
Thank you. And before we kind of go into our two big questions or like closing area, I have one last kind of question in this area for you, which is, our world today is shifting so much politically, environmentally, technologically, and you've spent your life responding to change and leading through uncertainty. So The world today is, I think, more uncertain than ever. And 2025, which we can kind of see from 2024 as well, is very likely to be filled with changes. So, what do you have to say for people? What advice do you have in dealing with uncertainty and dealing with change?
Yeah, I think the most important advice is hope is not a feeling. Some people, by nature are optimistic and say, therefore, I'm hopeful. Others are half glass empty people. I'm pessimistic, as if it's just a feeling. Hope, I don't think, is a feeling. Hope is a choice because the alternative to hope is despair. Now, don't confuse grief and despair. I really feel great grief at us being off target when it comes to climate change. I feel great grief at inequality, at slipping back on world poverty, and but grief is just different to despair. I choose to hope, and because I choose to hope, I'm going to keep on acting and believing that things will change.
Thank you for that. Very inspiring and very, very well phrased as well. This part of my podcast is something I've kind of done with my all of my guests so far, but it's basically two big questions, and it's kind of like a final reflection for my listeners to take with them. So my first question for you is, when you look back on your life's work, what would you, this might be hard to say, but what would you say you're the most proud of, not just in terms of like a role or an achievement, but what really matters to you?
Each chapter I've been proud of. The chapter of St Kilda Baptist and the law practice. The chapter setting up Urban Seed and a drug centre for heroin addicts at Collins Street Baptist. The World Vision time. Very proud of. Going back to what really matters, I'm most proud of the fact of three children, five grandchildren, a marriage of 45 years. That's what I'm most proud of.
Thank you. And my final question for you is, what would you say to any young person who's listening, or any person in general who's listening, not just about careers, but about life in general? What's something you think is important for us to, keep in mind and know?
I would encourage you to see that life is a gift. We didn't choose to be here, but it is a gift. And there is incredible beauty and sensuality and opportunity to express what gifts you've got in the midst of pain and inequality and struggle. So I say to young people, remember, life is a marathon, not a sprint. In the marathon, you've got time to look around, to see the beauty of the trees you're running past and smell the roses and not think I have to achieve everything. Just enjoy the gift.
Thank you so much. So, Mr. Costello, I really appreciate you coming onto Taught Not Told and sharing your wisdom, and for making the time. I think what you've said has been a powerful reminder that leadership is like a really broad term, but leadership doesn't just mean having a voice, it means also using your voice to help others and inspire others. Your work has spanned so many different spaces, but I think today you not only talked about that, but also about yourself as a person and what you believe. So thank you for that once again. Thank you for your time and insight, for leading by example. It's been a privilege having you on Taught Not Told. Thank you so much.
Lovely. Thank you. A delight.
Mr. Costello has spent his life fighting for justice, but what stayed with me the most was his belief that hope isn't something that you feel. It's something that you choose. And that made me think, how often do we wait for hope to find us instead of choosing to seek it out and to create it? His journey is a reminder that the world doesn't change just because we wish it would. It changes when people decide to step up, even when it's hard. I'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode. Feel free to reach out at taughtnottold.pod@gmail.com. Together, we're working toward Taught Not Told's mission, sharing lived wisdom to help young people navigate life with clarity, curiosity, and confidence. Next week, it'll just be you and me again, and I'll actually be diving into something that's come up more times than I can count. I've had people ask me, are you doing all of this because your parents are forcing you? And Honestly, I do understand why they might think that. There's this common idea that working hard, especially as a young person, must be tied to some external pressure or big end goal, like getting into a top university or building the perfect resume. But for me, that couldn't be farther from the truth. I do what I do because I love it, because I find meaning in being engaged with the world and learning and stepping outside my comfort zone. But this did get me thinking, why is this assumption so common? Why do we sometimes struggle to see ambition as something that can be self-driven? In this next episode, I want to unpack where this mindset comes from and why, for me, the idea of just waiting for life to happen has never felt like an option. Thanks for listening and for letting these stories be part of your journey. Until next time, keep listening, keep growing, and remember that some lessons are taught, but the best ones are lived. See you on Taught, Not Told.